Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is in the matter of Dua Tao. I hope I pronounced the name correctly. If I didn't, please correct me if I'm wrong. This matter is A21-1375 and A21-1579. We are proceeding by Zoom today. As you know, each party will have 15 minutes for your oral argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll ask that you please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your oral argument. You will see the time is being kept in the grid view. If there's any issues with the technological issues, we'll make sure you get your full allotment of time, but hopefully we won't experience any issues today. And I'll just remind anyone who's observing that we are recording this oral argument. We're making an audio recording, and no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. So with that, attorney for relator, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Attorney Jasper Berg. I am the attorney for the realtor here, Mr. Tao. And number one, we thank the court for allowing us to present this case. This case is about an unemployment claim, or specifically something called pandemic unemployment assistance. In the materials that were submitted, you'll notice the acronym PUA. This is a special type of unemployment benefit that is a result of the CARES Act, which was passed just a short period ago. The idea of this case for Mr. Tao is really based on likely an error of law by the unemployment law judge in the application of that pandemic unemployment assistance law, or PUA. And unfortunately, during that process, one of the elements were not even addressed during Mr. Tao's hearing. And that's the reason that lots of very significant facts were not developed. So that's the basis of Mr. Tao's appeal. There are some very specific details of this appeal that I'd like to bring to your attention. And the first is that there are periods of time, specifically three periods of time, where the applicant or Mr. Tao is seeking this pandemic benefit. And this claim is supported by the CARES Act. So these three periods of time is likely why you're seeing lots of documentation of different department records or decisions that they granted. And unfortunately, there's so many decisions here that it can be a little overwhelming. So these three specific periods of time are going to be in the summer months of 2020, the winter months or the winter break of Mr. Tao's children in 2020-2021, and then a period of time after April 2021. So that's the idea behind this appeal. I'd like to educate the Court of Appeals on really this error of law that I'm trying to bring to the court's attention. The respondent made reference to the law in their brief, specifically footnote 42, which is on page 11 of their brief. I think that's a very good, it's word for word for the these 11 COVID-related reasons for unemployment. Where the error of law likely really takes off is that there's a second or a supplement to that law, which was drafted and created by the Department of Labor. I've included that in my materials. The respondent has also included that in their materials. There's lots of memorandums from the Department of Labor that have tried to facilitate how this COVID law applies to unemployment settings. And there's just a lot here, and this law has consistently changed. But in its application to Mr. Tao, it's question number 39 of this change. I have included that in my materials. And when you take a look at that question 39, And that's the titling from the Department of Labor.
Mr. Burke, can you tell me what page we're looking at?
Sure. So I'm in my materials, I'm referring to E2 of my addendum. There's an E1 and an E2. There's many pages that are missing between. They're not relevant here. E1 is kind of an introduction to this memorandum. It's not really in a memorandum. The Department of Labor calls it an attachment. And you'll also notice they call it UIPL number 16-20 change I. There's really no significance to that naming, but there's many changes that the department produced. But the idea of bringing this to your attention is this third paragraph on E2. And really, this COVID law, this pandemic unemployment benefit law, applies to situations like Mr. Tao, and that when you have a facility, whether a school or even a child care provider that closes, the applicant, Mr. Tao, is eligible for benefits if he's unable to work and he needs that facility to be open in order for him to work. And that's his situation. The error of law occurred where at the hearing, at the phone hearing process, there just weren't zero questions presented about child care for Mr. Tao's children. Plenty of questions related to the schooling of his children, but the rule or the law supports the closure of schools and facilities. And that's really the idea of this appeal.
Well, counsel, as I understand your argument, you're focusing on the language from the U.S. DOL that says that if the facility that the individual relies on to provide summer care for the child is also closed as a direct result of the COVID public health emergency, he or she may qualify for PUA under paragraph DD of the CARES Act. Is that right?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct, Your Honor.
So in that regard, what questions should the ULJ have asked to develop the record that weren't asked? I know there were questions about summer school, but what other questions should have been asked in your view?
Sure. Well, Mr. Tao has five children. Not all of his children are school aged. Based on my experience, I think it would have been very relevant to be inquiring about the care that Mr. Tao's younger children were receiving or not receiving because of the pandemic. The law here, this pandemic unemployment rule, applies to the younger children as well. But the unemployment law judge also could have engaged Mr. Tao's setting, which is very difficult, his home setting, and whether or not he had care and what his children were doing once the school year concluded remotely. In this setting, I can imagine the unemployment law judge just being overwhelmed with cases related to pandemic unemployment benefits. So I'm not surprised that these questions weren't asked because the caseload is probably very significant here. And the law or this rule goes out of its way to identify school. And some of the records Mr. Tao presented at his hearing were specific to school, his charter school for his children. But this rule supports the closures of other facilities, not just schools. Just given the circumstances of Mr. Tao and his family trying to cater towards three children who were school-aged, studying remotely, that's really where the conversation started and ended. The record refers to one of Mr. Tao's children who was attending summer school, but was not attending summer school in the year 2020. And I just think that the conclusion of that conversation, for whatever reason, didn't trigger a conversation about Mr. Tao's other children and what he was doing with other facilities that were also closed. The case law here in Minnesota that also supports this is the case White v. University of Minnesota. And in that case, there was circumstances where the applicant wasn't able to develop the record for themselves. And that this court decided that the unemployment law judge should have developed the record. Well, we have a very, very similar situation as the White v. University of Minnesota case. And unfortunately, Mr. Tao's situation is a personal struggle. It's a personal struggle because of the balance of this many children remote learning, but also Mr. Tao and his family is homeless and receiving care from a generous entity. That's my definition of a personal struggle. That's what the court decided in the University of Minnesota case. Ms. White had a personal struggle as well. And unfortunately, those facts weren't developed and weren't fleshed out. You know, another
Mr. Burke, since you're pausing there, I'll jump in. I was trying to skim through my notes, and I can't recall if in the White case there was an appeal of the denial of reconsideration as well as the determination of ineligibility.
So for I don't know the exact procedure for that case, but very likely there would have had to have been, because that's the only way the case would have gotten to the Court of Appeals, and that's the only way the case would have been remanded, because she would have had to have filed a request for reconsideration. The law says that's a necessary element. So in my experience, I think there's very strong case law that would have denied even the Court of Appeals looking at that case had a request for reconsideration not been completed.
So I guess the follow-up question then is, if we're looking at, as you've framed it, kind of two different decisions, the request for reconsideration denied, you're appealing that decision as well as the underlying decision that you wanted to reconsider. But when we're looking at the decision to deny reconsideration, the statute requires good cause, at least if you're under the first part of that subdivision 2C. 2C1 requires two things. One of them is good cause for not submitting the evidence earlier. So the follow-up question is, if you're simultaneously saying that the ULJ did not satisfy its duty to assist and also challenging the denial of reconsideration, is there some case law to say that good cause includes failing to satisfy the duty to assist? Or is that something that a link that we have to make here? Or potentially a third option is, under our authority to reverse and remand and modify the underlying decision, there's no requirement, as I read it in the statute, for us to find good cause if we're going to remand the underlying decision without regard to the reconsideration request. And we're only looking at good cause to the extent that we're analyzing the decision to deny the request for reconsideration.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's the latter. The latter is the first element of remanding this case back to the hearing process. And as a result of that, there's no need to even address the good cause for the reconsideration. Because the idea of the applicant or Mr. Tao or the realtor submitting this additional feedback was the surprise that the unemployment law judge was so off the charts with this error of law. In other words, for whatever reason, this third paragraph of the Department of Labor memorandum was not addressed. The applicant tried to bring that to the unemployment law judge's attention in the submission of early documents by kind of starring some of the rules that the applicant thought applied in his case. But again, the whole idea of this appeal is the starting point of the record. There's very few facts that are relevant here. And had the judge asked just another layer of questions here that the rules supports, the applicant here would have been able to address that. Unfortunately, the applicant came across very nervous. You can see that there's multiple points in the transcript where he was making unrecordable statements. Not surprising, given where he was taking that phone call in a one room bedroom with five children and a spouse around him. Yes, Ron, I'm sorry.
Under the statute to reverse and remand, we need to find that the, sorry, I lost my spot here, that appellant's substantial rights were prejudiced. So, you know, assuming we were to agree with you that the record wasn't adequately developed, how were appellant's substantial rights prejudiced?
Sure. That's a really easy one. He was prejudiced in he was denied eligibility for unemployment benefits really under four different time periods. The first time period in the summer of 2020, the second time period of the winter of 2020, the third time period being the spring break or the spring spring week of 2021, and then a fourth time frame of after April of 2021. The after April of 2021.
Can I jump in, Mr. Burke? Because yes, as sir. I mapped this out, it looked like there were two periods of ineligibility, the summer 2020 from June 14 to September 5th, and that was tied to a specific issue ID number. And then there's another one for the Christmas break with a different ID number. But as I looked at what happens as of January 3rd, 2021, there's a determination of eligibility through April 3rd. And I thought that the determination of no eligibility starting on April 4th was specifically because schools were no longer closed. So I didn't see a third period of ineligibility due to another break. I don't see that spring break period. So perhaps I just need to be corrected, or maybe there's some clarification you can make about that April 4th period of time.
Sure. I'm going to speak to the April 4th period of time first, because that's the most significant. In this context, the hearing that Mr. Tao was engaged in occurred before April of 2021. In other words, the discussion between Mr. Tao and the unemployment law judge about when does the school open was a philosophical discussion, because the time period of when the school opened hadn't even happened yet. Mr. Tao was confused just based on his statements. But the record wasn't even developed on whether the school was open or not, because the unemployment law judge didn't inquire about Mr. Tao's two other children, the two children that were not engaged in school. The law here supports the closure of other care facilities. The judge didn't address that. As far as the school element of the rule, Mr. Tao still had a child that was remote learning that required him to be able to help that young child. But the reason why that's an issue in this case is really two reasons. First, the discussion happened before the events even happened. And second, there's two children here that were not even discussed on their care situation.
If I could follow up, then does it even matter if the school was closed, because you have two children who weren't school age this entire period of time? And really, if you're saying that those two children and daycare for those two children is enough to qualify, then why don't we just focus on that? It doesn't matter about the school at all, right?
Well, the reason why it matters in this context is because I'm leaning on what the unemployment law judge shared. The unemployment law judge said, yes, here are a handful of timeframes where the school was remote learning, and the judge found eligibility for the applicant.
Right, but you're also making a specific argument that even when the schools reopened, that there's still eligibility because of two non-school age children. So yes, to the extent that you want us to agree with you on that point, then that to me seems like that would have been the case throughout this entire period of time.
I agree. That's a fact pattern that was undeveloped that is very significant to this case.
Okay. And then if I could proceed, I see the time has lapsed. Presiding Judge Cochran, may I ask one more question?
You may.
is there any authority specifically to non-school age children and daycare that would support your interpretation of I can't remember all of the U.S. code, the paragraph double D?
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. I think paragraph double D speaks for itself because it says it's a school or another facility that is closed. In this context, another facility is a child care provider. The reason why the Department of Labor memorandum came up is because the unemployment law judge relied so heavily on the school portion. And this memorandum says that it's not, this rule isn't limited to school. It's limited to summer care. And summer care can be anything. And here we have a qualified circumstance because Mr. Tao was limited to the child care access that he had in the first place, and that was closed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for Deed, you can proceed when you're ready.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent Respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED for short. So the ULJ here determined that Relator was eligible for PUA under criteria DD, the school closure criteria, for weeks when his children's school was closed as a direct result of COVID-19. However, the ULJ determined that Relator was ineligible during those weeks when his children were on break from school and when the school reopened for in-person learning in April. And this result is consistent with the language of the CARES Act and with Department of Labor guidance, which addresses the school closure language specifically. So importantly, PUA eligibility is determined on a week-by-week basis. Section 9021 addresses eligibility for weeks of employment. And kind of the clearest language in Section 9021 about that is the language about continued requests for benefits. Each week, an applicant has to certify that they meet, that they continue to meet one of those 11 COVID-19 related reasons for being unavailable or unemployed. Unemployment Insurance Program Letter 1620 explains that many of those reasons are likely to be temporary, that it's some weeks an applicant may be eligible and some weeks they may not when that criteria no longer applies. It goes on to state that when a school is not closed as a direct result of COVID for purposes of DD, when that school year ends, and then the school is closed for a different reason, in other words. So the ULJ here—
Counsel, would you agree, though, that the guidance from the USDOL and Clause DD aren't limited to school, but also another facility that provides care for the child, in other words, summer care for the child? And so did the ULJ adequately develop the record in this case where the ULJ was focused solely on summer school and not other care that may have been needed for the children during a summer break or another school year break?
Well, I do agree that DD applies to the closure of other facilities and is not limited to schools. Here, I think the ULJ, asked the applicant as far as, you know, why he was unavailable, and the response was because I was helping my children with school. And I think the ULJ then did focus on the older children's school and the applicant helping the older children with the homeschooling. And that's the information that Relator provided to the department. He provided a packet of information from his children's school. The ULJ asked him about his school-age children. And so I think the ULJ was just focused on the issue of the older children's school. At no point did Relator bring up in the hearing that his younger children were at a daycare facility. Relator never testified that he was unable to work or unavailable to work because some other facility closed. So that wasn't brought up, and I don't think it was on the ULJ's radar. So I think it first came up in the request for reconsideration. In the request for reconsideration, the Relator did submit a letter stating that his children participated in a Head Start program. And the ULJ declined to issue or declined to order another hearing, reasoning that that wouldn't change the outcome because the letter doesn't say that the school was closed during the summer. So in that regard, I agree with you that the relator did not develop the record about the closure of the Head Start program because he didn't know about it. It wasn't on his radar at all.
The ULJ, though, didn't ask about care for the school-age children during their breaks, correct?
Well, right. The relator testified that his partner was taking care of the younger children.
Right.
So there was no testimony that the younger children were ever in a daycare program. My reading is that the ULJ assumed, based on that testimony, that the younger kids were at home. I don't think he knew that there was a daycare situation at play. So there weren't any questions asked about the daycare dates or the schedule or that type of thing. He never testified that that was a reason for his unavailability. He testified his partner took care of the younger children. He testified that he, you know, was looking for work and willing to go to work, but he never testified that the closure of a daycare prevented him from working. And so that didn't come up until the request for reconsideration. And at that point, the ULJ was required to apply the statutory criteria for looking at new information in a request for reconsideration. Under that statute, the relator has to show good cause for not providing that information during the hearing. And he has to show that it would likely change the outcome of the hearing if it were admitted, or show that testimony submitted at the hearing was false or likely false. So in the decision, the ULJ reasoned it doesn't show that the kids were scheduled for summer school. And he is relying on testimony in the hearing. You know, the judge did ask him, do your kids normally attend summer school? You know, relator said a few years back, but not in 2019. The judge asked, if the schools hadn't closed, do you know whether any of them would have attended any of them, he says. Could the relator have been thinking he was just referring to his three children? That's possible. But the judge asked, do you know whether any of them would have attended summer school during 2020? And he responds, I couldn't say yes. So, I mean, if he was planning on his younger children being in a daycare facility during the summer or during any of these times, you know, he had an opportunity to say that, and he never said that.
Wasn't the proceeding conducted as a question and in a question and answer format? I mean, to me, that is partly what is a little troubling is the ULJ, it was a question and answer format, really. And so it seems like in that format, it was incumbent on the ULJ to, under the rule, you know, to ensure that all relevant facts are clearly and fully developed as provided in 3310.2921.
Yes. And again, I don't think the ULJ knew about it to ask about it. Could he have asked that question, were your children, your younger children ever in a daycare? Certainly. That would have been a relevant question to ask. I'm done. Go ahead, please.
Okay. And I think I misspoke earlier because I have the statute in front of me and then I lost it. But if assuming, you know, without deciding here, if there the ULJ didn't fully comply with the duty to ensure that the record was fully developed, we could remand without finding prejudice. Is that your understanding of the statute 268.105, subdivision 7, paragraph D, which provides that the Court of Appeals may affirm the decision or remand the case for further proceedings. And then the language about substantial rights only talks about if we're going to reverse or modify the decision. We may reverse or modify if the substantial rights of the petitioner may have been prejudiced.
I agree with you. I believe the court has remanded cases to develop the record and get more information without a showing of prejudice. And that may be an appropriate path here if the court finds that the closure of the daycare may have been a reason for relator's unavailability or inability to work. So that I believe the court could remand to further develop the record on that point without a finding of prejudice to substantial rights.
Ms. Phillips, if I could just be as pointed as possible about the question I have when it comes to the children who are not old enough to go to school. Do you agree that if there's a daycare for non-school age children that was closed, that that's a facility under double paragraph DD, that eligibility should have for a family like that, that they are eligible?
I do agree. Yeah, I think a daycare would be a facility. And if it had closed and then that made the relator unavailable for work or unable to work, that would satisfy DD. I do.
The ULJ knew the ages of the children?
He did. He asked about the ages of the children. And he asked about school age children. And the relator identified the three who were in school.
Were there any questions about a facility other than school?
No, there was not. I think the relator testified that his partner was looking after the two younger children and that he sometimes helped. So it's my reading that the ULJ assumed that the two younger ones stayed at home and didn't ask that question about another facility. Again, I don't think it was on his radar that was at play. Just based on the information that the relator presented when he applied and when he submitted his appeal, it was all, you know, his assertion was that he was unable to work because he was helping his children with homeschooling and while his partner was caring for the two younger children. So I think the ULJ was focused on determining his eligibility based on that information and didn't consider whether the younger children were in a facility. So that was never brought up, unfortunately. But to answer your question, I believe that a daycare is a facility.
Well, in the middle of the silence, I'm going to jump in with another question just to clarify some things. In regards to the two different decisions, and if we have authority when we're reviewing the decision or the determination of ineligibility to, as we've already discussed, remand for further development of the record, I'm assuming you would also agree that we would not need to address the second decision on the request for reconsideration and therefore not address whether there was good cause or this tension between good cause and duty to develop or duty to assist?
Yes, I'm having a hard time separating them in my mind, but if you remand to further develop the record on the issue of the daycare closure, I agree that I don't think you have to reach the abuse of discretion on the request for reconsideration issue. On the other hand, I don't think you have to reach that. I think you could remand to further develop the record on whether the closure of the daycare, you know, makes relator eligible for PUA under DD, because the judge didn't consider that in his decision. So I think that would be appropriate to remand for that information, kind of aside from the other issue of abuse of discretion on the request for reconsideration.
Aside from the issue of was there good cause provided, and potentially also aside from the issue of the duty to assist, that there's an option for us to remand to further develop without finding that the UL or concluding the ULJ failed in that duty or making a conclusion regarding good cause. We can still remand for further development, right?
I believe so. Okay. That's how I read the statute. The court can remand. It has the authority to remand to further develop the record and for the judge to consider this other eligibility criteria that he didn't consider. I think that would be consistent with the court's authority in the unemployment insurance statute, and that may be an appropriate remedy here because the judge didn't consider that. I don't have any other points that I wanted to make. If there are no other questions, I will conclude and ask that the court affirm the ULJ's decision. In the alternative, the court can certainly remand for the judge to further develop the record on the issue of whether the daycare closure meets the criteria under DD for PUA eligibility. Thank you for all your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. And Mr. Berg, you'll now have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. On rebuttal, Mr. Pitao would just like to bring highlight a couple of points to your attention. If this case was remanded, I know personally that Mr. Tao's younger children were impacted by a facility closed, but this also impacts his school age children. In other words, this isn't limited to just his two younger children. This is all of his children. There's some very fine line details in the decisions provided by the ULJ that unfortunately, can also be addressed. And that's specific to these overpayments. In other words, the ULJ made a decision in two of the cases that the applicant owed $399 and $276. How the department came to that conclusion is very important because it's Mr. Tao's experience that the department did some unclear math that really had a negative impact on his account. So the remand needs to be broad because a third point here is that the issue identification numbers that were submitted on this appeal, I think the department would be able to confirm that those numbers are no longer in the applicant's account. And I can see lots of confusion once again at the department stage. If this case was remanded, they are going to be left with what do we do now? This is an account that unfortunately is just in a state of chaos, just given the number of issue identification numbers that have been created with removed. And I acknowledge in one of the footnotes that the respondent submitted that there has been some discussion to try to correct it. But I see lots of value for the remand to be as broad as possible with the idea of being able to just clean up some of these errors that, the applicant's going to want to be able to point to help the department administer the benefit, ideally. And lastly, this is a significant case for this family. The respondent's brief suggested that I should have just identified certain facts and that would have been great, but the record is very undeveloped. We see that in the department's system processing errors that they reference over and over again. We see that in footnote 19, page 4, the respondent's brief, where they just wanted to provide context of other case numbers that are attached to the applicant's account, which really have no bearing on this decision at all. And then the addendum, the school calendar that the respondent submitted, which I'm grateful that they submitted a school calendar. There's no reason to hide from that. But these are facts that were never part of the phone hearing process with the ULJ. So And again, exhibit number 10 that that Mr. Tao submitted in his hearing process, he even brought to the department's attention that there must have been another person, another applicant unrelated to Mr. Tao, where that applicant's case was mixed up with Mr. Tao's case. And it's just, we just have so many layers of these errors that the department's calling system processing errors. But this is much, much greater than a system processing error.
Mr. Burke, do you have some suggested language if there was some agreement on this panel to go along with a remand to develop the record further? How would you prefer how would you prefer us to allow the relator to continue to address some dispute over the calculations?
Sure. So, you know, if the court and the respondent would be open to it, maybe I can try to draft something and defer to maybe some other decisions that have been made by this court. But ideally, a remand to develop the record to identify the impact of closed facilities, in addition to other system processing errors that have impacted the benefit awarded to the applicant. On the fly, that's very wordy. I can appreciate that. So, in this context,
I was just curious to see if you had something magic. But thank you.
Yes, I can't see the timer in front of me, so I don't want to be disrespectful.
Your time is up, Mr. Burke.
It is okay.
But if you want to briefly conclude, that would be. We would appreciate that.
Yes, Your Honor. First, Mr. Tao is very grateful of being heard today. He's not able to make an argument on his own behalf. I'm here on his family's behalf. If there was any qualifying circumstance, Mr. Tao's family is it.
Thank you very much to both counsel.